the reason these disturbances, they followed you to a new home, is because it's not the house that's haunted. It's your son.
So 1,100 men went in the war. 316 men come out. The Sharks took the rest June the 29th, 1945. Anyway, we delivered the bomb.
Never, ever, ever, under any circumstances, say, I'll be right back. Because you won't be back.
You get another beer, you want one?
Yeah, sure.
I'll be right back!
I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Oh, shit. Oh.
My name is Robert Hawkins. Approximately 7 hours ago, something attacked the city. You found this. If you're watching this, then you know more about it than I do.
California, stay away from me. Stay away from me. I'll come with you. John Doe has the upper hand.
And on that day, Ahab will go to his grave, but he'll rise again within the hour. He will rise and beckon that all save one shall follow.
They're all gonna laugh at you! They're all gonna laugh at you! They're all gonna laugh at you!
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how's it going?
I am well.
Excellent. And we have a Connecticut American.
This is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how's it going?
Oh, it's going pretty well as can be expected, I guess.
We do have our guest host from Virginia.
Hey, this is Barrett.
Barrett, how's it going?
It's going great.
Excellent. And we were supposed to have Abe from Massachusetts joining us shortly, but he told us to start.
He just joined.
Yeah, I'm right here. Hello.
Hey, hello.
We got Abe
from Massachusetts. How's it going?
I'm doing well.
Excellent. All right, so we're all on schedule. Everybody's here. And before we get into what we're going to talk about tonight, for folks who don't know who we are, new listeners or whatnot, we are Dark Discussions Podcast, a podcast that critiques and reviews genre films, so horror, sci-fi, fantasy, thrillers, techno thrillers, mysteries, grindhouse, art house, cult films, midnight movies, and whatnot. Basically, we try to talk intelligently about a genre that deserves intelligence. I got that one right this week, Eric.
Yes, you did.
2 weeks
in a row.
So we do have a website.
Even though you forgot what actual week it was, but we won't go there.
Yes, that was pretty bad. So this is darkdiscussions.com is the website. And Eric, what can people find on that website?
Oh, man, they can find so much stuff there. On our front page on the right-hand side, you can find links to Friends of the Podcast, so check all them out. Up at the top, you can find a link to an article section where there are articles written by myself as well as others. You can also find an audio section which has every episode of Dark Discussions as well as any of its spin-off podcasts available for download for free. There's bound to be something that interests you there, so check that out. And then front and center on the front page is a link to our Patreon account. Patreon is a service that allows you to financially support your online artists like podcasters. Producing this show is not free. We have to pay for movie rentals and equipment and server fees and so on and so forth. So if you'd like to help us offset the cost of producing this show, that's how you can do it. For every $5 a month that you care to donate, For every $5 a month that you care to donate, you'll have the opportunity to pick a topic for us to possibly cover on the show. We take all the suggestions from our patrons and draw one at random on a quarterly basis to do an episode about. So if you'd like to do that, you can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions or follow the link on the front page of darkdiscussions.com.
Yep, very good. And we do have a couple of Patreon coming out soon. They're in the queue to record, so they'll be coming out record sometime during the summer or early summer, I should say. That's pretty much it. Oh, I remember. darkdiscussions@aol.com is the email, so send your emails to us, which we actually do have one email tonight. And you can also go to Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group, where you can join the conversation, all things genre over there. So the email we got, email is from Amy Rain. Amy Rain does the Fishnets and Phantoms podcast. It's temporarily in hiatus, but people may know it through the Dark Discussions Podcast Network. But she does have an email about the movie The Lodge that we did an episode on and was just released earlier in June. And this is what she says. She goes, "Hey, guys, good show on The Lodge. I watched it last night, too. I thought it was okay. Didn't adore it. Sorry, Phil. Also, thanks for thinking to say I might not like it because of poor Grady's demise." Yes, the dog. "I use the Does the Dog Die app before most movies, so I know to brace myself now. I wonder if the weird existential purgatory plot thing was because the directors are German. I could totally see Werner Herzog reading some of that. I agree those kids are dicks. I felt so bad for Grace. She was just trying to be a good stepmom. Also because I'm me, and I felt bad for the shrimp." Yes, the sea monkeys. "That said, why the F was the dad? What the F was the dad thinking? Yeah, let's make my fiance and kids hang out in the family cabin filled with stuff from the dead wife. Nothing says Christmas like that. I guess I found the movie to be a bit too muddled with what it was trying to say. In the end, it seemed like it didn't know itself. Other than you F with pets, you're dead, which, hey, you know. Anyway, thoughts. Oh, my God, that Santa was creepy. That balloon thing was weird. Yeah, you're dead. And I'm surprised no one mentioned the extreme claustrophobia of the weird two small rooms. And it was creepy, the Virgin Mary painting. Oh, and the Japanese anime nosebleed signifies horniness. Okay, thanks for the show, Amy." Yeah, and actually, you know what? I rewatched the film, and it was actually Grace that suggested the idea of going to the house for Christmas and being there alone with the kids. But that is from third hand from the father, and it's also still probably stupid for the father.
I'm gonna have to watch it now.
Yeah. So it's that was pretty good. So I'm glad Amy got to check it out. If you have Hulu, it's there free right now. If not, you can rent it for like $5.99 or less, and it's also on disc. So check it out, The Lodge. One of my personal favorites so far this year. All right, so I think we can get into our topic tonight. So, Eric, what are we going to talk about tonight?
Tonight, we are going to be talking about a movie that's currently available to rent on demand digitally called True Fiction.
"You're young, sweet, polite. That's all well and good. But we really only have one concern, and that's selling our client's book.
Your bedroom. Your phone, please.
What if I need to make a call?
He needs an assistant, not a writer. That's his job. Which are you?
Are you?
Did you bring your writing?
No. I was told not to.
Do you always do what you're told?
This game is a controlled experiment in fear.
You want me to be your guinea pig?
You're here to inspire me, aren't you?
There's not an exit I haven't sealed. Nowhere that you can hide. And I will find you! Just like I found the others! Ah!
We've got some really good stuff here.
That's right. True Fiction did the festivals last year, but it was released February 21st 2020 everywhere in at least the United States. The film is directed by someone named Braden Croft, and it stars Sarah Garcia and John Cassini, among some other minor supporting roles. It's a bottle film in the sense that it basically takes place in one building with just a handful of characters. It is a very obscure film in the sense that it hasn't been released by any bigger companies, never mind smaller companies like Magnet or anything. So it's just one of those really, really small production companies or distribution companies. I don't know anything about the people involved, though I did find out John Cassini, the lead male actor, is Canadian. But that doesn't mean the film's Canadian, because I couldn't find out anything else about the film, if it was produced by Canadian companies or if the director or Sarah Garcia are Canadian. But there's nothing. We went in completely blind to when it was picked, but just based off of the wiki that Eric's going to read later. So let's get into our thoughts about the film and how we heard about the film, though I don't think any of us knew about the film until we picked it last week. But let's start with you, Eric.
All right. Well, I had not heard about the film until we were going through a list of titles last week to try and choose one. And the synopsis sounded interesting. So we chose it. I enjoyed this movie. There are two main actors in the movie, and I thought they were both very good. I enjoyed the plot, and I enjoyed the messing with your head aspect of the movie. There were a couple of things later on in the movie that I was a little bit like, it kind of lifted something straight out of another very popular horror movie, which made me kind of raise an eyebrow. But for the most part, I enjoyed this movie quite a bit, and I would generally recommend it.
All right, sounds good. We heard about it, same as Eric. It's a pretty solid film. It's getting good reviews by critics and whatnot. The acting is fantastic, as Eric mentioned. The first hour of the film is phenomenal. I did have some major problems, or minor problems, or just problems, for the last 37 minutes of the film and whatnot. But the first hour was really, really solid stuff and whatnot. But it was a pretty decent film. Let's go with you, Chrissy.
Same for me. I didn't hear about it until you guys mentioned it. I liked it. I, of course, was very drawn to the fact that it was about a writer. I did enjoy how they sort of weaved some of these very typical things that writers say to each other into this. I liked some of the comments it had to make, particularly about predictability and people's behavior and things like that, which I will go into later. I thought the acting was good. I did, like Eric, enjoy the screw around with your head aspect. It was kind of fun because it felt like every 5 minutes I was like, ooh, now there's something else I got to kind of figure out. And I did like that. I liked the atmosphere. I don't know. I felt there was maybe a little bit of a weakness in some of it, but it wasn't enough to really bother me. However, I really feel like they tried to do something different with, kind of like Eric said, a sort of a predictable sort of plot that's been done before. And I'm not quite sure it was different enough. I think I've seen this movie before, even with the twists, but I still enjoyed it. So I think for an hour and a half and for $4, it was a pretty, I don't want to say a good time, you know, but yeah, it was a good time. It was good.
Sure. All right, very good. I think I'm right there with you, Chrissy, actually. And let's go with Abe next.
So I heard about this film because it was what we decided to talk about for this week. I watched it today, and I did like the performances of both our actors. I thought they were really they really worked well off each other. I did love some of the kind of mind screw moments of what is reality, what isn't, and what is truth and what is fiction. Or true fiction at this point here. I did think there were some really eerie moments. And I did get it's kind of funny we mentioned The Lodge, because I got a lot of familiar beats from it, in that we have one group of characters in this case, who have something planned for one outcome, but it completely backfires on their target of the subject of their plan, and goes spiral out of control. With the characters of Avery and Grace being fallen down into this pit of insanity. But it didn't take away. It just kind of made me think of it. Remind me a bit of it. I did also, I am kind of with Eric and Christy, and how the last bit of it wasn't all that unique or new. Overall, I did enjoy the watch. It was well paced enough that it didn't drag. And it's going to be interesting to kind of talk about and dissect as where it would place in terms of the films this year. It's kind of hard to say, but it's certainly not a bad film. And I think it's something that's, I could certainly recommend to somebody if they're looking for a interesting psychological thriller. So, yeah, it was a good watch.
All right, very good. And Barrett?
I really liked this film. I thought it was really good, well-paced, well-acted. There were a couple scenes and a couple things that left questions in my mind that I don't think were explained well enough. A scene at the beginning, a scene at the end, and then one character who doesn't appear at a certain point when I would have expected it. So it just, it was a really enjoyable film, but other than those few minor things I had problems with, I really highly recommend it.
All right. Very good. Sounds good. So, most of us think it was solid enough, if not splendid, but, no negative reviews. Eric, do we have a wiki?
Wiki.
A young writer gets a job assisting her favorite horror writer, but she finds herself participating in an out-of-control psychological experiment.
All right, and that was the wiki that when we were reading off the wikis for a bunch of films to possibly do for tonight's topic, that was the one that caught folks is the most, and Eric said, let's do it. And I said, all right, let's do it. So complete blind, none of us knew anything about the film until basically last week. I had it on a list. Someone had recommended it somewhere along the line, and I put it down, and that's the list I was going off of when I was throwing them out. All right, so I guess we can talk about non-spoiler stuff first before we get into everything and anything. I loved the first scene. I kept on bothering Eric about it, and actually I sent it to you too, Barrett.
You're such a dork.
That was awesome. Starfucker.
It wasn't that awesome. Mentally unstable.
I had to rewind it seven times and rewatch the scene. It was awesome. Anyway,
see, now, it's interesting that you say that, Phil, because I really liked that scene. I actually was sort of hoping that I really wish that scene had been the first scene instead of that little teaser that we got. I kind of didn't care for that little teaser at the beginning. I felt that it gave a lot away and didn't leave enough of a surprise for us to sort of find out in case you hadn't seen the trailer. But I did like that scene, but I did feel like it wasn't like that was a golden opportunity for them to build in just a little bit more about her character, just to maybe establish her weaknesses a little bit. There were also a couple of things that were thrown in, once we do spoiler alert, as complete surprises at the end that were just didn't make sense. And I think that could have been a place they should have put it or had it referenced. That was my only problem with that scene. Otherwise I liked it. I thought it was more compelling than the little teaser at the opening, which just kind of telegraphed too much, but
I think some of it is that they don't actually know as much as they think about her.
Hmm. Oh, maybe.
That scene.
Yeah, and I'll explain that further in when we get to spoilers. But
that makes sense because, you know, it kind of goes
back
to Christy was talking about, you know, predictability and unpredictability.
Yeah.
Right.
No, and I think, yeah, when we talk about that, Barrett, definitely. But then I think there were other pieces of information that should have been revealed to us in a different way then.
Absolutely.
Because that just didn't, there were some things where I was like, what the fuck? Like, we didn't know that. And it just came out of left field. But,
yep.
Yeah, but we'll talk about that after. Okay, sorry.
I know exactly what you're talking about, too.
Yeah, I bet you do.
For folks who care, we forgot to do this earlier. We're recording this on June 11th, 2020, for folks who are curious, such as one of our listeners, Pam.
Thank God.
Also,
I wasn't going to be able to go on unless you did that. I was starting to have an anxiety attack.
Fair enough. No, that's fine. OCDs, man. OCDs. And when people look for this film, if they are interested in it, make sure you rent the correct one because there's like 18 films named True Fiction. So look for 2019 or 2020, directed by Braden Croft. Sarah Garcia is the actress. John Cassini is the actor. So that's the best way to probably find out.
I didn't really have any trouble finding it, Phil.
Really? Yeah, because when I kept on getting a bunch that were popped up, and I always picked the right one just because it was the most recent. But I could see someone like going for one that was 2017. There was one that was 2017 too. I think you're right. I think most people will be all right.
I recognize that Cassini guy. He was in the Continuum show.
Oh, okay, interesting. Yeah. So, most of these folks are probably television actors or whatnot because they're no big names yet, or they're just starting out. I mean, the girl could be just starting, or woman could be just starting out. All right. So, any other things anybody want to bring up related to the film in general versus spoilers? What did people think of? Even though it wasn't the lead character, it was the co-lead, people thinking of having an author as a lead. For example, Stephen King, almost every other book.
All of his books, yeah.
Yeah, the lead character is a writer, probably because that's what he knows best. So it's a common trope in horror films, I guess. What did people think of that?
It was well done, I thought. I thought it was used in a good way.
It was a different take on the character archetype that you know usually in other stories has been done to death. So this was interesting experimentation on how to play around with that, play around with it and do something different, or more at least at the very least mostly different.
I thought that now when Phil and Chrissy tell me they're doing research, I know what they mean.
Oh, Eric, you have no idea what the fuck goes on in my basement. That's all I have to say.
I think I need to do research.
Yeah, that's a fair point. What else do we want to talk about? I guess we'll just, unless anybody else has anything else, we'll just throw out the spoiler alert.
Yeah, it's hard to talk about this movie without spoilers.
Yeah,
absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, we kind of have to just do it.
Yeah.
All right, people. So, our listeners, if you want to see the film and not be spoiled, this is your warning.
Yep. All right, so spoiler alert is up. We can talk about everything, anything. And just to set it up a little, we're not going to go scene by scene, obviously, but, you know, like be a commentary for the movie, but we're going to talk about and critique various scenes. But to just set it up, we find this masked person in a room during the middle of the winter, like a cabin or something. And he has a like typical slasher or sadomasochist type clothes, whatever. And he's going like making grunts and whatever. So you figure, okay, there's going to maybe some sort of slasher or whatever. There may be a corpse in the bed. I think there was, or someone was in the bed, but I can't really remember. And then that was like the pre-credit scene. And then the main setup of the film is basically this woman, young girl, or young adult, is going for an interview for a position to be an assistant for a famous horror writer. Actually, we don't find out it's a horror writer until she gets the job, but a famous writer anyway. And she's interviewed, resume and all that, and the two people interviewing her, a guy and a woman, are kind of snobbish types, asking, questions that would make her feel like she's worthless. And they kind of
go ahead, say it, Phil.
Rude to her. What's that? What was I going to say?
Say it.
You know what you're going
to
say.
You know you want suck? To. Say
people
it.
Suck?
No, the question.
No.
Oh, yeah, I forgot the question. But
oh, my God!
Oh, my God!
You were texting me about it for 10 minutes straight last night.
Well, what she did is she says, answers a question. The girl answers a question like, oh, I'll do anything. And then the woman interviewer asks, are you a star fucker? And I think that's it, right, Eric? That was hilarious.
Yeah, that's the one that you thought was so funny that you had to rewind it three times.
Yeah. Jesus, I give it an extra star for that. Oh, it was hilarious. I mean, it was just, I don't know, it came out of nowhere, and it was, like, hilarious. And the girl's expression, like, no, that's
it. It was well-placed. I have to admit, it was well-placed.
The scene was reminding me, gave me Starry Eye flashbacks.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that film, yep, Starry Eyes. I agree. Abe, I agree. But either way, they get her to finally basically say, so what's special about you that you should get this job? And she says, well, there's really nothing special about me. And they do give her one compliment on that. They go, oh, honesty. Okay, that's good. But she leaves thinking she's not going to get the job. The next scene, we see her basically in a dream flash sequence.
Is it a dream? I don't know. That's one of my problems with that scene.
Yeah, there's this like TV show similar to like the Actor Studio or a PBS type of show where someone is interviewing someone of note. And it was more of an art housey type of show than a mainstream show because, you're not going to see famous authors on Jimmy Kimmel. For example, you only see actors and musicians, while you would see maybe some authors of note on these art house type shows like PBS or whatever. And
yeah, it struck me like a Charlie Rose type of deal.
Yeah, exactly like that. And she's being interviewed about being a famous author or something, and she's all excited. And then we kind of make it feel like it's a dream or whatnot, but I don't know. You Barrett, you think it may not be because it's something that happened in the film?
No, I think you're correct that it's a dream, but it's strangely like what happens. So I find it really odd.
Right.
And it just doesn't feel like it fits there. I don't know why, but it feels odd to me. That
right.
scene.
Yeah, so she's...
It's kind of like the beginning scene of the movie. I don't think that should have been in there either, like Chrissy said. It's just a scene I don't think was needed at that point.
Yeah, the only reason I can think they put it in is she's one of these wannabe writers that looks at her herself... Like if when she becomes famous, what would happen? And she's imagining herself on this guy's PBS Charlie Rose.
It actually reminded me of the Joker scenes where where the character leaves himself. He's on the comedy show and everything like that, and just all these fantasies and stuff like that.
That's a good parallel, Ed.
And she does seem to be looking at a TV, but you can't really see. It seems like she's looking at a TV, and that's when she imagines that. So.
Right.
And also, I think they just needed to kind of get it out there that she was an aspiring writer. I mean, they do have conversation about it later once she gets there, but we didn't know that yet.
Right, right. And then they show her at her job working at either a library or a bookstore. And a coworker comes up and says, yeah, there's a phone call for you. And there's kind of... I don't know why they had it in there. They had it like he was interested in her and wanted to ask her out, but
I guess it was just to kind of show that, you know, there was somebody, you know, I think it goes back to the thing how she said there wasn't anything special about her, but there was somebody who was interested and saw something special in her.
Yeah, like she thinks she's a social ghost, but she's not as much as she thinks she is.
Exactly.
I think it's kind of the point of that scene.
Yeah, it was kind of showed that somebody saw the value in her, or was at least interested in her, outside of a professional sort of thing. And that kind of goes back to when later in the film where everybody else is just using her as an asset.
Right. Well, and that's kind of interesting because, I mean, in real life, had they casted someone not as attractive, the scene would have probably had more emphasis, I think, because whether she's a depressed person or feels like a failure, because attractive people can feel failure and be depressed, they usually, at least, even if they have problems in the dating scene, they're still going to be approached often just because they're attractive. So I think the scene absolutely is what you guys said it was. It's just that I don't know if it worked as well as I think it would have.
I think that's a problem in all films. They always choose really attractive people, even when they're supposed to be like, oh, they're supposed to be so ugly.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. They're supposed to be so ugly that no one would ever want to date them. And you're like, what are you talking about?
They're hot and you don't know it or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Just wait until she takes off her glasses and lets her hair down.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, from the Van Halen Hot for Teacher video, right? But yeah, so that I think that's exactly what they were trying to get at. But of course, based off of what we discussed about how casting directors cast attractive people, it didn't work as well as I'm sure they were trying to get across. Even though it did, I guess, get across because I mean, that's
well,
we all
I think
that.
I think what you know, one of the things. As far as we're still talking about that interview in the opening scene, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. I really think, you know, Barrett's point about maybe they think they don't know a lot about her, but the problem is for me is that she didn't come off pathetic and desperate enough, you know? And even when she was like begging, but I really need this, you know, Barrett, can I go there with the son at the end?
Oh yeah.
What the fuck was that? That was completely out of left field. It had nothing to do with anything. She, when they were pressing her, oh, you have no family, you have no this. First of all, where the hell did she get a son? I mean, the whole thing was just weird.
Oh,
that
was really weird. Yeah.
Where did they get
really
their information
weird.
From to not know that?
Yeah, I mean, that was a problem for me, particularly because there was a beat there later on in the film where, you know, she's talking with the guy about, oh, abortion, and he says stillborn. So I think there was some kind of connection that she was supposed to make with that guy that would suddenly make her call her son that we didn't even know she had. I mean, it would have been much better in that scene if instead of just whining, I really need this, please, if she had said, I need to support my son. Who's staying with? Yeah, and where the fuck is the kid anyway? Who, if she has no family, who's she staying with? Like
that
was a real problem for me. I was just like, what? Like when she was crying on the phone. First of all, we don't see it's her talking right away.
Right.
So you hear this female voice, and even though you assume it's her, and it, you know, sometimes it's hard to tell if it's the same voice. You know what I mean? So I was like,
especially
wait a minute,
crying and all that stuff, right?
Well, and I feel like it was an attempt to get us to have sympathy for her, but it didn't work because there's no background to her having a child.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the first point they mentioned it was way back when she's in the garage.
And that's the only point they mentioned it. They never mentioned it again. That's the only point it's mentioned.
I thought it was so weird. I texted Barrett saying, she has a kid? And he goes, yeah. And you text me back saying, yeah, I have no idea where that came from either. It just came out of nowhere.
I think it was just weird.
Yeah,
go ahead.
It felt like they were trying to add more twists upon more twists to just like, you know, keep one up and everything that was going on.
And that wasn't needed.
No, but sometimes these kind of films, they always feel like I, you know, keep adding them on and be like, oh my God, you weren't expecting this, were you? Oh, were you expecting this? No, this is it. And just keep completely throwing curveballs at the audience just to make them feel like.
Yeah, and Abe, I've talked about this before, and I know you guys all agree with me because we've all watched a lot of bad movies, great and good, you know, great and terrible alike. And we've all, you know, some of us write and stuff. The thing is, in order for an effective twist to work, and I've said this before, you need to justify it, which means it cannot just come out of fucking nowhere. You can't have that. That's not a twist. That's just dropping shit in there for whatever fucking reason because we felt like it. Like, that does not work.
I mean, so we can't determine what the reason was.
And it doesn't match. It doesn't match the whole background of her character from the rest of the film, where she says, "I have family." I mean, if you're going to say you have no family, that makes no sense because you would say, "I have a child." You know, anybody who had a kid that they talked to wouldn't say, "I have no family." I mean,
it's almost like she's an unreliable narrator, but she's lying to the people that are hiring her, and they're lying to her. So it's like they don't know. They think they know everything about her, but obviously they don't know. But that really has no effect on the plot. You know what I mean? Like, them not knowing that doesn't change anything.
Well, and here's my other problem with this. So she has the son, which is probably why she leapt to the conclusion of, oh, abortion. You know, when she was talking with what's his name there? The guy, Caleb. You know, when they're all bloody Caleb. Yes, thank Caleb. You, because I got them confused, Caleb and Colton. But anyway, so she jumps to that conclusion, which I thought was fucking weird. I was like, why is she jumping to that conclusion? Then, of course, a couple scenes later, we find out she had a kid. So that then, I was like, oh, that's why that was her first choice. But here's my thing. She says she has no family, right? We already mentioned, who's taking care of this kid? Now, what would have been interesting was if she's clearly unstable, right? But we are shown that through this interview, which I think we were supposed to kind of see that, but it wasn't written well enough for me to really get the point that, oh, this girl is a little unstable. You know, because unstable people can seem perfectly together under certain circumstances, and then, you know, they could be a different person behind closed doors. So what if the kid was staying with the father and she really needs the job to prove to herself, to prove to other people or to whoever, okay, that, hey, I can hold down this really awesome job and I'm going to make my writing career work so I can get my son back. That would have made it interesting. Mm-hmm. And then when she's calling the kid at the end, it would have made sense because look at all the goddamn murdering she just did. Yeah. So now it's clear that she's unstable and she's never going to see her kid again. That would have worked. Why the writers did not do that, I don't know. Maybe there's shit that ended up on the cutting room floor, I don't know. But that's the only way that shit would have worked, in my opinion.
Which is funny because there's a scene where the author brings her a piece of his story, and she's criticizing it, says there's no stakes. And it's kind of like it almost.
Oh, she's eating steak. Sorry.
But there's an opportunity for it to kind of almost a reflection of her words in that.
Because she doesn't, her stakes in this, the problem with that opening scene is that her stakes are never high enough.
Mm.
That's the problem. And that's really what we're talking about when we're talking about things like the son or even her sister, right? Now, there was another totally failed subplot missed opportunity. Okay, so let's say she doesn't have a son, right? She's totally unstable because of her sister. Now, they could have worked together. If the son had been written the way that storyline had been written the way I suggested it, and then you lump the sister on top of it, oh my Lord, what a double whammy. That is a fucked up character. That's a character who's been beaten by life. That's a character who's interesting. Now, she goes through the whole movie and turns into a goddamn psycho who's actually strong, like she becomes in the second half of this movie. But that was another problem I had. Where did all of a sudden those switch flipped and now she's just strong? I don't
consider her a psycho, though.
No, but
she was just defending herself. Yeah, they were driving. They were driving her insane, and she just defended herself.
Yes, but they were
people. First degree murder. It's kind of psycho.
Well, but I mean, she did go over the edge.
She did.
Even a moment where he says to her, and here's another line that didn't make sense. Don't abandon me like you abandoned your sister. Okay, now wait a minute. The sister, and they say this twice in the movie, left and didn't come back.
Well, that's what she said. That's the problem.
Okay, so that's not working either then, because... See,
she's an unreliable narrator.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, but that wasn't clearly enough established for me. There weren't enough subtle clues.
Right.
I need to see a couple of subtle clues to be like, oh, she's fucked up.
And see, he could have lived, but he drew her back by saying that to her.
Oh, yeah. Well, this guy, for all the plan this guy does, he is an absolute idiot.
Yeah, he causes his own demise.
Yeah, he does. He does.
Yeah.
And everybody else's, for that matter. She flips when she realizes that she came back to save that woman. That's when you see her break completely.
Right.
Well,
when
and
she realizes that was an act.
Well, and also, that's the other thing where Caleb says to her, oh, you know, this was all about saving your sister to heal yourself. And I was kind of like, okay, that would have been a good thing, too, if that had been well built. That you got the sense that she really did feel guilty about her sister, because you never got the sense she felt freaking guilty about it. She after that room, you know, that that film that she's watching and blah, blah, blah. And then we see that little teary scene that she has with him about, oh, my sister. But I'm not seeing any deep seated trauma here from it. It seems like she's just whatever. I don't know.
Well, part of me questions whether they were planning on killing her in the end. I think maybe they were.
I don't know.
No, I think I'm going to back Barrett up on this one. I think they might have been too, because the whole thing about nobody even knows where you are.
Uh-huh.
You have nobody in your life, so on and so forth. So at one point, he was acting like it really didn't matter if she did die, because nobody would care anyway.
And I think he would have been the one on the stage rather than her if he'd have succeeded.
Well, I still don't think, as I told you, Barrett, this morning, I don't think she actually made it to the stage. I think when he hit her, she just bled to death on the floor, and that was like a dream as she's dying. But
I would agree
know.
With you, except it shows the guy coming from the office, coming out of his car and grabbing her.
Yeah,
putting a blanket
that.
Around mm-hmm. her and all that.
Right. No, the end of the movie was a little problematic.
Yeah.
First of all, where the movie started to lose me a little bit is when she's got him handcuffed, right?
Yep.
And then and she's about to go upstairs and do something. She goes stairs here, and then she goes, "Oh," and she puts the machete on the floor and says, "You'll never get through the chain." I'm like, "Oh, God, really? We're going Saw now?"
Yeah.
Well, and both his hands at that point, after he takes his hand off, are mangled. I mean, he'll never type again.
Right again.
yeah, and then I believe that the scene at the end with her on the talk show is real. However, I'm thinking to myself, if all this actually went down the way they show us in the flashes at the end of the movie, she would be in jail. She or a psychiatric institution, one of the two things. She would not be doing the talk show her circuit, because even if she successfully killed him and dragged him back into the house and set the whole place on fire, they're still going to find that his hand was cut off from his fucking arm, which is going to raise some questions.
Yeah, I think she was trying to say that the brother
did it all.
Did it all.
Yeah.
Is what
it's still an investigator, I think.
Which makes no goddamn probably, sense at all.
Yeah, an investigator would probably be able to figure some of that out. Couldn't be true. There was too much that happened in there for it not to be able to be found out.
Right. And they, they would do a lie detector test and know that, though that's not admissive, that would immediately make her a full suspect and all various other things.
The thing is, though, if they had built her correctly as the unreliable, you know, narrator, like Barrett suggested, which is what I think they probably were going for, they just failed. If they had done that properly, then she could have bullshit the lie detector test. There's a lot of things she could have done because there are ways to bullshit that. And if you're smart enough, you can figure it out. The other thing that I wanted to mention, though, is that I did think the title was interesting just because, you know, this is all about perception, right? And like a lot of times when writers write, not everything you write that's fiction is 100% fiction. You know, sometimes you do put things in your work that actually did happen. And it's that we perceive things through our own experience, but it's how we remember them that is what the writer eventually records in fiction. Okay.
Which
is always faulty. And so I think that the title actually does serve the film well in that it does kind of give us a clue about the deeper meaning of this, if she were built correctly as an unreliable narrator. Does that make sense? Was I clear or did I totally?
Well, yeah, and this could all be her explaining what happened, which would make the whole movie unreliable, right?
Right.
True, yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing, go ahead.
I was going to say, I like how they played off each other. Like, he said certain things to her, and then later on, she says the exact same things to him. And he says what she said back to her. That kind of makes it feel a little too pat for me, which makes it more unreliable than me, if that makes sense.
Well,
yes. It was almost too perfect.
It was too perfect and in some spots. And it was also, like I said, although I enjoyed some of the things about that they were saying about writing, like, you know, that's why all that matters is the work and not the person behind it. I mean, my God, that's writers say that all the time. You know, they had a few like fun, like writery things in here that if you are a writer, I think you just get a kick out of actually saying them. But then again,
and it ended on a writer's joke.
It did.
Yeah, it did.
But then, you know, purposeful exposure to the purest emotion, you know, that's a big writer thing. However, what's also interesting about that is that most of these things that they're talking about are out of the mouths of, all right, I'm just going to say it, a lot of amateurs or a lot of wannabes, not the people who actually write, like, write. Because we all go through that stage where we're young writers, we're new in our walks, right? So we're all quoting this shit. Like, you know, purposeful exposure to the purest emotion and blah, blah, blah. I mean, that's all crap you're talking about when you're young in your walk. Once you really start getting developed and you're really developed in your walk, meaning I'm not talking about how much you're published. I am talking about how much you live the writing life. In other words, are you writing every day? Are you honing your craft? Are you, you know, really working on your art? You get beyond all of that. And I do think there was another interesting thing in this movie, too. There's the whole thing about where he talks about things being predictable. And, you know, and that's interesting, too. This guy I know, Todd, he was always on my ass all the time. And he would always be like, I actually texted him tonight and said, you know what? I just proved your predictability theory wrong because I figured it out. For 3 years, we've been arguing about this. I said, everything is predictable. He used to say, everything is predictable, right? He goes, so a person we know is going to behave in a predictable way, okay? Which is what this dude and these people were banking on when they got her, right? Mm-hmm. They assumed she was going to behave in a predictable way.
Right.
Okay. However, even if they didn't build this character correctly, right? She is a dynamic character, or she's in a perfect, if this script were perfect, she would have been a well-developed dynamic character, even if she was unreliable. Because then later in the film, he says to her, oh, you're actually not predictable. You surprised me. So here's the thing. I think one of the messages of this movie is that the outcome of a situation and how that person is going to behave is only predictable if that person stays static. So if that person is an unchangeable character, in other words, they do the same behavior all the time, and they don't learn their lesson and they don't grow, then yes, you can predict what they're going to do, right? Like a loser is always a loser until he wakes up one day and says, oh my God, I'm a loser. I got to fix this, right?
Well, by
so thinking- until then he's, but do you understand what I'm saying? I think there was a point to be made there, but if they had just done a little better with her arc, I think it would have been a stronger point. But
yeah, I agree. Their research, they thought that she was going to be predictable.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing everything they did, they made her unpredictable.
Right.
Right.
Right, because she was forced to grow and change.
Exactly.
Because she had to fucking survive in extreme circumstances.
And they forced her to look at herself.
Yes.
They forced her to look at herself.
Exactly. And a lot of people don't grow and change unless you stamp a freaking hot iron on their asses and go, hey, dude, right. You're done. You got to change.
Well, this is a thing that I've said in the past that, you know, if Charles Manson had been born in a normal family, such as, say, your next door neighbor, he would have grown up and, you know, been your next door neighbor mowing his lawn and you'd wave to him. But when something, because he was already, but if a person's damaged, like they say, a lot of people who go to war that come back damaged, they may have been apt to be damaged in the first place, and it's some massive traumatic event that makes them snap. And so what this film here is showing is a girl that probably was, we definitely knew she was damaged based off of, you know, the things she says about her sister and all that. But maybe had she not had this traumatic experience in this author's home, she wouldn't have snapped and she wouldn't have become a psychopath murderer. But because this traumatic event was enough to make her damaged snap, you know, the ability of a damaged person to snap, that's why she went off and did what she did. And the other thing is the question is the character likable enough to support her through the second half of the film, or is she unlikable? And it's like, well, I mean,
I think she is.
Well,
Sorry, Bear, go ahead.
No, that's okay. You go ahead.
I was just going to say, I'm with her up to a certain point, which is like when she stabs the guy in the mask. Yeah, okay, I get it. She thought he was a serial killer and her life was in danger, and she reacted accordingly.
Herself.
And then after she is not allowed to get out of the house and all that, I understand her kind of going after the author. What kind of lost me was when she whacked the woman.
Because
I was like, that she didn't do anything.
Yeah, she treated her rudely at the very beginning.
Well, if I killed everybody that treated me rudely, there'd be a lot of fucking dead people.
Well, she was already in this killing mood, and I think at this point they had
turned her. Oh, well, if she was in the mood, then
she was at this point, I think, wanted to help him write. The way he had kept pushing her, it was her intention to help him write at that point.
Well, she does make some comment about, she was your muse. Oh, I know, you want your wife. She was your muse. Now I'm your muse.
Exactly.
Now I understand and this is hard. I get the whole somebody's your muse thing. And the problem with somebody being your muse, because it does exist, is that once they fall from grace, they are no longer your muse and you're without one.
Yeah,
you know, so
no more writing.
By her actually killing the wife who apparently he loved, that really kind of doesn't change the fact that the wife is still his muse, you know, even though she's dead. She didn't necessarily fall from grace in his eyes, right? So she's still going to be his muse,
I'm sorry. I may have missed something in the movie. Was the woman she killed his wife?
No.
No, she said that.
Okay. Okay. Sorry.
I thought it was.
No, I don't think that was the wife.
No, I think
that
was
just his assistant.
Yeah, one of his agents or assistants or something like
that. Because he even said he didn't love her, but he did love his wife.
Okay, I was totally confused or I missed it. Okay. I probably missed it. My bad.
I'm understanding a little more why she was torturing him and asking him about his wife and his child, stillborn child, and all this other stuff. It's like, why does she care about any of this? But
she's trying to get him to write.
Yeah, because it's part of the writing thing. Yeah. But I don't know. But you know, if that's the case, why would she be chopping people's fingers off? Because she knows damn well a writer needs their fingers.
Because it's fun.
Once she broke and she killed the woman, she was done. She went over the edge.
She was in the land.
Yeah, she basically went totally crazy once that happened. You see her break, and then she just starts doing really crazy stuff.
Right, and then she goes and calls her son that we didn't even know she had.
Right. Yeah, right. Which makes no sense.
Yeah. You're right, right. And her turning of when she snaps, unlike some people who just become depressed or tunnel vision or whatever, her snapping is becoming a psychopath, first degree murderer that tortures people and kidnaps them. Because technically, she was kidnapped in a sense, but she definitely kidnapped people too, because she wasn't allowing people to leave either. And the thing is she had an opportunity to just leave, right? But Barrett, you said that, you know, he egged her on to come back.
He did.
But I thought that change was just, I don't know. I would have thought she would have just left at that point. I couldn't believe she would go back.
She knew exactly where to hit her to get her to come back.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, they really build it up that he knows everything about her, because we find out that she is what we call that's true. she's basically a stalker fan, because she writes a letter to him almost weekly and talks about her personal life, you know, and it's not like he ever wrote back to her. So she's just writing to this. That's like any of us writing to a famous person over and over and over, that, and as if we're, is a two-way conversation, or isn't, and we're telling them our deepest secrets and desires and stuff. So she's obviously has some behavioral, she's a behavioral health individual, Chrissy.
The technical term is wackadoodle.
Yes.
Or
yes. Cuckoo
for Cocoa Puffs.
Yes. And to be honest, since I didn't
behavioral health individual, I still love that.
It's almost like a misery in reverse.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. It kind of is, yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I didn't even think about it that way, but you're right. That's kind of cool.
Well, nothing will cause the hammer to the ankle.
But just set it up a little, because we didn't really set it up. Basically, what happens is she gets the job. She goes to this remote, what we call a wealthy person's cottage, which basically means a mansion. And she is introduced to him, and it's just going to be him and her working on getting him to write again, because he's had some years now that he hasn't felt like he's written anything good. And so to do that, she has to agree to be in an experiment, which is basically stated in the wiki. And that experiment is basically she has to be put in a state of fear, because he wants to observe her and what fear does, so she can he can then take that emotion or something and put it into his writing, I guess.
Basically, he wants to see like raw data, like real, actual representation, not an actor or actress, someone who's actually experiencing it as if their lives are at stake.
Right, right, exactly. Yeah, and so what happens is it gets a little bit out of control, and the guy is also gaslighting her big time. Because,
by the way, as far as I understand it, that's not how you do sensory deprivation.
I know, that was crazy sensory deprivation.
No, no, that's just torture. That's not sensory deprivation.
That was torture.
Yeah,
sensory deprivation
totally
involves a tag.
Well, this guy is not the brightest. As much as his for all his planning, he's definitely not all that smart as he thinks he is.
That's true. That's true.
His plan's really bad, and you know he acts completely surprised when she starts acting irrational. I mean, this is exactly what she wanted, but he's like, oh my god, this is not what I wanted. This is really backfiring. But it's like, you wanted to scare the shit out of this woman and drive her nuts so you could have this, all this stuff for your book. What were you thinking was going to happen?
Right. And then he also makes himself look like he's a villain. So, in other words, which he is, but the point is that he was... The question was, is that if he's trying to scare the hell out of her, the first part of the film when he's doing it, he is just a bystander that's basically gaslighting her by saying, what are you talking about? I don't see that in the film that you're watching, or what woman are you talking about? There's no woman here, and on and on. But then he literally becomes the villain, and he breaks that wall. Yeah, yes. The mystery, right? And so when he does that, he technically becomes the target, even if it's just play role and she doesn't know it, meaning, you know, this is all set up, and then at the end of the film, he goes, you know, like the movie The Game, for example, Eric, like that movie that we've seen.
Great movie.
Yeah, that is a great movie, where you just find out it was all a game, and it wasn't real. And that's what I was expecting that this may have was going to go to, but... when someone is psycho like her or damaged like her, and like you said, Barrett, and you said, Abe, the moment that it starts backfiring, it's like, whoops, I didn't expect it to go this way. He didn't have any checks and balances, or just didn't end it and say, yeah, it was sorry. I apologize.
He pretends to end it a couple times, and then he convinces her to go back into it. So he had a lot of opportunities to live. And I really think that he was going to kill her in the end. I don't think that she was going to survive.
Yeah, maybe that could be true. Yeah, maybe he was a psycho in the sense that he was actually a serial killer. It's not really answered though. It's never answered.
Right.
Because now I'm rewatching the movie as we're you know in the background, and that scene at the beginning where we see the psycho S&M guy with the machete and the mask is actually it's a flash forward. It's not
right.
Yeah, so it's not really a prequel part of the movie. So now I don't know if he is gonna, because in other words, I thought maybe okay, someone was dead in the bed, and this was what happened in the past. But now that I know it wasn't something that happened in the past, I don't know if he was going to actually kill her.
I feel like he was just because of the way it was set up. It was, you know, totally in this abandoned, you know, really far out area. And he pushed it so far, I felt like they wanted to push her over the edge so that they would eventually kill her. And then he would be, you know, the author talking about this horrible experience where she tried to kill him.
It's also weird that he didn't have protection on him. Or keys that were hidden all over the house that he could have gotten. Like when he gets locked in the basement, you would have figured it's a one-way lock, right? So you go in the basement, you can't get out. And so you would think he would have had a key down there or something. I mean, it was just, yeah. It's like
or
you
a
said,
key to the handcuffs that he gives to her to put on him.
Yeah, it's, yeah. Yeah, and why Well, that's another thing. Why would someone allow themselves to be handcuffed by someone they think is nuts?
He's an idiot.
Well, yeah, no, here's my biggest problem. Where the heck is Allison the whole time she's chopping fingers?
I know. She's just
That bothered me the most of anything, because she turns up, but not until after three fingers are gone.
Yeah.
What is she doing in the interim? How does she know to come at that point, but not before? That I didn't like.
That was kind of bizarre. I agree. I was just kind of like, and then wasn't there some, now maybe I got this wrong so you guys can correct me, but wasn't there some weird thing where he was like, well, if I call her, she won't answer or yes. something, right?
Yeah.
So you can call her. Is it? I don't know. That was just weird. Yeah. I mean, like, why would she come to the girl's voice but not
right
when the girl is the one that she's actually supposed to be not against, but you know, she's getting paid to play the I don't know that totally I got right. lost there.
Well, if you would have he would have had a safe word, you would think, you know,
yeah,
so that's something he could scream or yell that would let Allison know that okay, you know, you do come now.
And he waited till his third finger to say it? Whatever. You know, I mean, it's like,
yeah.
She should have come sooner.
I know. It was
the safe word is, ow, fuck, she's chopping off my fingers.
Yeah,
she's on the third one. And it's my right hand.
Jeez.
Well, and at this point, let's take a break for a second and say that it seems like we're piling on the film pretty bad now when we think about it. But I guess it's because, I mean, again, we all fairly liked the film. I mean, it was a good watch, yeah. like Chrissy said, it's not an enjoyable watch because it's a horror film. But as a entertaining horror film, it is enjoyable. But I guess it's just some flaws
minor
out there.
The thing about the minor details,
While you're going through the experience of watching the movie, you don't think about all this because it's going by quick enough that it's entertaining you.
Right.
It's only in retrospect that you stop and think about all the little details where you really come up with all of this stuff.
Yeah.
So while points we're making are valid, I don't think they're really as severe as it sounds like with us talking about them. Because when you're watching a movie, they just go by, and it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, it's just that kind of moment where you look back in hindsight. Sometimes it happens immediately, sometimes it happens a little later, but, you know, they're not story-breaking. I mean, there are kind of things that felt like they could have been patched up, or maybe they were victims of, you know, things being up in the cutting room floor. You know, there's a lot of films like that. And that doesn't make them any less enjoyable. It's just sometimes some things are just not picturesque as they are planned by the writers or directors.
Well, and the unreliable narrator part of it lets me look past some of that a little bit, only to an extent, because some of them still bother me. But that also plays into it for me.
Right, right. Well, and that's the thing. It's like, when was... I didn't know. When did you think she became an unreliable narrator? In other words, I wasn't sure if she was unreliable until near the end, because they were gaslighting us, the audience, as well. Like, is she really seeing the camera of her at the middle of the night and people watching her when she's watching the psych film, to, you know, for reactions? Or things like that. So, yeah, is she just crazy? Is she just going crazy? Or are we being gaslighted too? And so, I don't know.
What gave me that feeling was that scene where she's dreaming about being up on the stage. I just didn't feel like something about that just hit me and made me feel like she was unreliable from there on out.
Right. Well, for example, co-host Mike always says he gets disappointed when they use dream sequences in films because they're kind of cheats. And in these here, they had enough dream sequences of her, you know, with her and her flashback of her sister being killed or something. And then the creature under the bed and her walking around.
I don't think that was a dream sequence.
So you really think there was a creature under the bed?
No, I think they had something under there to scare her.
Maybe that was the actress.
All right, but I swore once she sees that, she wakes up out of bed. So, but yeah, but I don't know. Yeah, so I don't know. Yeah,
it's
maybe,
not immediately. It's like it. She's walking around after that, and then all of a sudden she wakes up on the bed. There's no showing of what happens. You know what I mean? Like it could have been a dream or not. It could have just been, you know, go to black screen and now she's waking up. You know what I mean?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. I guess it was a little confusing as all, for, at least for me. I don't know. But
I think that was their intent.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that's on purpose.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
They want you questioning it and what is real, what is not real. And It's definitely provoked a lot of thoughts in my head.
So one thing that's interesting about the film then is the film is both gaslighting and unreliable narrator. In other words, she is an unreliable narrator at many points in the film, but also a lot of the things that are actually happening around her are actually happening around her, and it's not her just imagining it. So I think that is kind of a unique take on the quote-unquote unreliable narrator film, because at the end of most of these films, everything or a good portion of it is still questioned because we find out that, oh, she's just crazy, or, oh, he's just crazy. But in this film, we pretty much know what is real, but her behavior and irrational acts make her most certainly an unreliable narrator if a lot of the things that happened are true. It's just that we're looking at those things that are true through her perspective. And so if we took away her perspective and looked at it through, say, Allison's or Caleb's or someone else that's just watching her, maybe they wouldn't be as dramatic. I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know if I'm fully on board with the unreliable narrator angle. I think most of the stuff we saw in the movie either happened or was done to her by the author to try and scare her. And
yeah, I would agree with that.
Then we later find out that it was done to her. But I don't think she's imagining those things. The author is trying to make her think she's imagining those things as part of his little torture experiment.
Gotcha. And then she just becomes a wackadoodle.
Yeah, she snaps. Yeah, I might snap too if a good dude in a black hockey mask came after me with a fucking machete.
yeah, that's true. Yeah, and that's the thing, is that she obviously thought the guy with the machete was going to kill her, right?
Right, well, the machete was real. They actually a point where he actually stabs into the ground. So, and, you know, there was no way her understand this was all part of the game at that point.
Right. But man, did she stab the fuck out of him. That was awesome.
Oh, God, yeah.
That was a great scene.
Is he dead? No. Stab.
And she wears that blood for a while.
All right. But you know what? I don't think that guy was actually going to kill her, and I'll tell you why. Because the reactions of both Caleb and Allison later would be different, I think, because
plus he answered the question on the lie detector.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
he
said she wasn't. He wasn't going to kill her.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, because throughout that all those interrogations, those questions, he keeps mostly passing everything, if not everything, and it's actually frustrating her. So no matter how much she tries to tell the truth, she doesn't believe it.
Now, he might have killed her after she did that first stab in the face or whatever. At that point, I think he went over the edge.
He was definitely pissed that she murdered his brother.
No, that's, I mean the brother, when she first gets in that room and when she stabs him kind of in the face.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. And he gets knocked over, then he gets kind of mad and he comes after, and that's when he's on top of her and she gets him in the neck.
Right. That's true. That's true. Yeah. 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 Because the moment he gets poked in the eye, you know, now he's permanently disfigured for life. He could have snapped himself, meaning Jacob's, Caleb's brother. Yeah. Yeah. So basically, I have to explain a little more. So Caleb is in the house with her alone, but we find out that his brother, who was the chauffeur that brought her to this house in the wilderness, is actually in on the game, and he's supposed to be he's the S&M dressed guy and is supposed to be like the slasher killer that's supposed to chase her around to frighten her. And based off of the lie detector test that Caleb says, he wasn't really going to kill her. But of course she doesn't know that, and she freaks out, and she just gets up a hand and kills Caleb's brother. And then Allison, the woman that interviewed her at the beginning that said Starfucker, she is playing a role too as a captive in the basement. And the thing is that as a captive in the basement, Caleb sets it up where it makes it look like either she, meaning our heroine, believes that there is an actual person being kept in the basement by Caleb, and Caleb's a sicko, or she's imagining it because Caleb keeps on gaslighting her, saying, "What are you talking about? I don't hear anybody screaming in the basement." And when they go downstairs in the basement, he goes, "There's no one here," and yet there is a woman there. And then eventually he admits it, and that's when she freaks. And the thing is that, yeah, it was part of his fright thing. So he was purposely gaslighting her and had his assistant, Allison, play a role as a captive. And then after she finds out all this, that she is a actress, Caleb still plays it as if she may still be a captive. So, in other words,
another opportunity he had, by the way, to get out alive.
Yeah, and I agree that it's really just really, really, really poor planning on his part that he gets locked down there.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're setting this whole setup up, how the hell do you let that happen? That's unacceptable.
Well, where's his brother at that point, too, though?
Oh, yeah, I know. Well,
I guess he does eventually let him out, right? Because then she finds him typing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you're right.
So he does get out.
Yeah, it's never explained how he's gotten out, but we can assume it's the brother. And again, that's more gaslighting by him because he's acting as if nothing happened. Like all the things that happened in the basement never happened.
Yeah.
It was interesting. It was strange.
What happens in the basement stays in the basement.
That's right. That's right. And that's the thing. He keeps on playing it up like he is a kidnapper and he does have woman tortured in the basement. But then he keeps on saying, no, it's an actress. Oh, but and us, we find out all along it was just an actress. But again, our lead character is a disturbed woman anyway, and so she doesn't know what the truth is, and then her craziness, yeah, it's a massacre.
A fucking bad day for everybody.
Then he gets her to read pages, and it gets to that page where it says, "You stupid bitch, he's right behind you," and that's when his brother shows up behind her.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a kind of a cool scene.
Yeah.
I think they replayed it way too much when she does the same thing later, and she has pages on the floor for him. I felt, that's kind of...
Yeah, the callback was a little on the nose, but I got what they were going for.
Yeah, same. A little on the nose, but I see what they were trying to do. I still think the whole sun and the call to the sun still came out of nowhere. It was almost like there must be other strange scenes.
See, that totally got by me. I didn't catch that at all. Like, I watched the entire movie, didn't think she had a son.
Yeah, weird scene. I just, it totally did not fit. And you're like, what the heck? They did all this research and they don't know she has a son? I don't get it. How is that?
Well, and they didn't even mention, and she doesn't even mention the son once in the entire film. And no. You know, it's not like there's a scene like Chrissy said where, Danny, I'm going to drop you off with my friend at work, and you're going to stay with him for the next week. Okay, I mean, there's none of that, and so it's just like
right
came out of
or
nowhere.
Even you know, they didn't even have to have a big describer scene. They could have done something very simple where she gets to the house, right, and maybe she's unpacking her things, and there's a picture of her son, and she looks at the picture of her son, and she goes, "I'm going to get you back. I'm going to prove that I can have a job, and I'm going to come get you, baby." That's all she had to fucking do. And that's it. 2 seconds. And then the audience would have gone, oh, she has a kid.
Right.
Oh, and then it would have made sense. Again, we just needed to know that was there. It doesn't really matter how they do it, but it also that, like we said earlier about the lack of stakes, despite the fact that she was eating one. That would have upped the stakes for her. Now she can't fuck up. So now when she's going psycho and stabbing and cutting off his fingers, now you're also horrified because you're like, oh, crap. Like, she's never going to get her kid back now. Like, this is not happening. Yeah. So I don't know.
And once she kills the woman, she's all in. So she has to kill everybody.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
Nobody can live at that point.
You got to commit. Gotta commit.
Yeah, that was the tipping point. And that's why I think, I don't know, like I said, this movie, I think despite the fact that, you know, like we talked about, it has been a little done before, maybe it wasn't different enough. I think it was a missed opportunity in that it really could have been a little more interesting if these storylines had kind of been put in there. So I don't know what was cut, but I don't even think it needs that much tweaking, for God's sake. It's not that much. Like, I'm thinking about it, and I'm going, dude, it's like maybe 3 or 4 scenes and a little tiny bit of rewriting, but not a lot. And it would have been great.
Like the whole handcuff thing. I mean, I couldn't believe that he would allow himself to be handcuffed when he didn't have an extra key somewhere. What they should have done was have her. Demand him to tie himself, and then she would take zip ties from the garage or something.
Or search him after he handcuffs himself.
Yeah, right.
Unless he's got it up his butt. You know, he's got a key somewhere, then.
Yeah. Well, and then the other
bend over, baby. I'm probing.
Other thing is, and not that everybody would have one, but I would think there would at least be one firearm in the house that he would have had for emergencies, that he would have pulled out and just shot her in the head and she's done, and everybody's fine, and it's over.
Yeah, you know? Not everybody has handguns.
Yeah, I know, but I
don't feel like the thing.
If you're that well, yeah, I mean, I'm American, you know. But
yeah,
but
Phil also thinks everybody should be walking around with 2 cell phones. So.
Dude, don't bring up the asparagus movie. So anyway,
your asparagus.
Hey, I know a lot of people that have 2 cell phones. Eric used to have 2 cell phones, and one from work and one from home. Are you
I
still
do, doing? But that's not most people.
I know.
No, it's not.
But why do you have two, Phil? That was my point was that you, the person in the house, the person trying to break into that house doesn't know that.
Anyway,
so why would they just,
about this movie.
Yeah, so this movie, I would have thought someone that's a famous author that has kooky fans would have has a house in the middle of nowhere would have at least have one firearm, but at least a knife
or security system.
I'm okay with him not having a firearm because not everybody.
All right, let's say he doesn't have a firearm, but you would have thought he would have had some sort of weapons hidden around a house for emergencies. I just think.
Or maybe a security guard.
Yeah.
His brother was his security guard. He just didn't last long.
Yeah, no. That's true. It wasn't his fault. His brother sucked as a security guard.
His brother was huge.
Yeah. Well, and then, yeah, well,
he's
anybody who lives...
dumb bunny, basically. That was the problem.
but he would have had...
like bunny, you know? Oh, if I hug it, it'll
had,
go deep.
He would have... That's true. That was a bunny. He would have had... a security system that he could have turned on, and then the cops would come.
He did. I mean, can't get out.
He doesn't want the cops there.
You can't even break the windows. Yeah, he didn't want the cops there. He was
psychological
doing
torture on this woman. He doesn't want the authorities involved.
That's true. She did sign the contract, though. So
I don't think that would hold up.
Well, and that's the reason why I don't think he was going to kill her, because he wouldn't have had her sign the contract.
Why not? Then if she did get killed, then he'd have this signed contract that said she signed away her rights, basically. And again, I don't think it would have worked either.
Or not necessarily if she got killed, but if you got caught.
Yeah, yeah.
She got killed, nobody noticed, then oh, cool.
Yeah, they get rid of the body. Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's my point, is that if he was going to kill her, he would have just done the psychological torture with her and wouldn't even alarmed her in the first place.
No, he wanted to see how far he could take it.
Yeah, he didn't want to kill her for the sake of killing her. He wanted to get his results and then kill her.
Yeah,
and he thought he wasn't done getting results yet.
Right, yeah. Right. Well, and plus he wanted a gaslight her, but by having her sign it and then knowing that she's in the experiment, he could gaslight her and then act like what's real and what's not. Like,
now here's the question. That contract that she signed, it almost, what was the guy at the end asking the woman to shred?
Oh, yeah.
At the very end, he says, here, you need to shred this. And then she starts reading it, of course, instead of shredding it. But he says, here, shred this. And then he heads out to the place. And I'm wondering what that is. That couldn't be the contract.
It could have just been, something to do to have in the scene of an office, and had nothing to do with the main plot, too.
It felt like it was part of the main plot. Like he was going to check out what was going wrong, and he wanted that shredded just in case. That's how it felt to me.
Oh, yeah. Maybe Barrett. Could it be possible that maybe it was a detail of their plan?
It could
or
be
an outline of the book, maybe.
Yeah,
the
maybe
proposed book.
All right.
That's what I was thinking maybe it was.
Well, and I don't see how they could have let her live if she was going to be the main character of the book unless they were going to change the character and, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
the names and
everything. Yeah, there were just some problems with this.
Well, he was. I thought he was going to let her be a co-author, and he was going to put her on the jacket as well. Because he says we're going to write it together. But again, that may have just been...
Oh, no way that was ever happening.
Yeah,
write it in blood together.
That may have been just a muse, yeah, I should be saying, yeah, sure, I don't know.
I will say I did, probably one of the little aspects of the movie I enjoyed the most was the fact that he had the two different versions of the video, one that included sleeping and one that didn't. So when she asked her to play it back, he was just like, what are you talking about? That was pretty awesome.
That was awesome gaslighting. I mean, I kind of... even though I thought she was going crazy, I also had the thought that, okay, he's probably just playing an alternate video.
Right, right.
But again, maybe that was partly intentional too, because they wanted the audience to wonder if she's being gaslighted or if she's just going insane as well.
Yeah.
So I think it was intentional, because we're supposed to see everything through her perspective.
I don't think she's not in a scene in the movie until you see that guy coming to go to the building, right?
No, there's a few scenes that Caleb's alone, like when he chops off his hand and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, that's true. But not many. She's in almost every scene.
Yeah, she's pretty much in almost every scene. Yeah, and the film is almost in her perspective the entire scene. So I think the writer / director, who's the same person, was trying to make us wonder too whether or not she's being gaslight or not. So, and you know, it's funny too, is another interesting aspect of the screenplay too, is even after she finds certain things and knows she's being gaslighted, it's still ambiguous whether or not she's going crazy, because later on you could even say maybe she is crazy and she just thinks she's being gaslighted and she actually is crazy.
Why can't she be crazy and getting gaslighted?
Yeah. And that's part of the problem. That's why they turned her into a killer. Cause when she's in that deprivation thing, she has visions of things that are a little crazy. Visions of her sister and all that stuff. I mean,
yeah, that's true. Right,
she seems
right.
to have some issues, pretty deep-seated issues.
Yeah.
Because there's no way they could have created the scene of her sister being killed by somebody. So that had to be all in her head. So that yeah, was
but they knew about the sister.
Right.
Because yeah. he admits to that at some point.
Yeah, yeah, they knew about it. But they couldn't recreate the scenes because she would know that they were created. So
right.
those scenes that were added into everything else most certainly showed that she was disturbed.
Right.
Yeah, I think what was really cool is that they did hint of some of the lingering scars so that similar to how they handled, with the character of Grace in the Lodge, I think they did a little better, but they at least showed there were some scars there, so it made more sense how quickly she started becoming unhinged.
Right, right. Oh, yeah, the Lodge did it way better. I mean, the Lodge, you knew the woman was possibly a behavioral health individual right from the beginning, and then as she broke down, Wackadoodle. And when she finally does break down in that film, it was 100% believable because the character was built up a certain way the entire time. So yeah, Abe, you have a really good point that this film is kind of taking beats similar to The Lodge, and that is a good point. Though The Lodge was done much much better. At least
well, yeah, Phil, because you have a good point about Grace in that it is established, you know, early on. We see enough of her past to kind of already know that she's unstable. And I think that was very well done in that film.
Oh, you know? Right. It wasn't exposition dumps. It was done through scenes of the, it wasn't like Grace said, yeah, this happened to me and this happened to me and this happened to me and this happened. Yeah, it was done completely differently. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And also, you felt pity for Grace right from the beginning when you found out that she wasn't a bad person. And then also, they didn't throw things out of left field about having a kid like in this film too. So the Lodge was a really strong film. Go on, Bert.
I think the best they did here was in showing in her first interview her maybe a little more attraction for the author than she should have, and she's trying to tamp it down, but that's the best you really get of that she's maybe a little unhinged, and I don't think that's a strong enough scene to really show it, because I think what they're trying to do is have this idea that she's fairly stable but maybe on the edge, so that she didn't seem quite as crazy and that it was more of a fall from normal you know what I mean?
At the beginning, she wasn't framed as a crazy person, just as a super fan.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. Well, and that's another problem with the setup. And again, it's not a true problem. It's a problem in the sense that they couldn't tell us enough, because if they did, which is, we want this girl and we're purposely going to bring this girl, similar to Ex Machina, where it was all intentional that they did a psych evaluation and they say, okay, we're going to pretend we're looking for somebody, but we're just going right for this person. We're bringing them in. That's what they did here. And as a result, they couldn't have a scene at the beginning where they're talking to Caleb and saying, all right, now this girl here that we're looking at, do you really want to have her? Because this is a crazy lady that's been sending you letters every day for the past 20 years. She's insane. So they couldn't have that. So they couldn't establish things like that. She's an Uber fan to the point of stalker and all these other things. Because if they did, then it would break away the reveal that all along they wanted her and they already knew everything about her.
Right.
But again, though, they didn't do it. I don't think they did it as well as Ex Machina. Ex Machina, they did it really good. And I'm sure Eric would agree with that, too, because I know you like that film, too. Because in that film...
Indeed.
Great movie. Because in that film, they had a contest in the company to see who was going to be the assistant for the CEO. And this kid wins it, and he goes and all that. And then you find out that he was
the contest was fake and they just wanted him because they knew he would be the person that they could manipulate the best. And here it was the same thing. It's just that X Machina did it much better, I think. So.
So we keep on veering off and talking about other movies. Does that mean we've said everything we have to say about this movie?
We're kind of going in circles at this point.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I really don't have a whole lot more to say. My main thing was, I think I brought up my few little points, and I think I'm good. Yeah, I mean, there were a couple of interesting symbols in here that they did, like motif-wise. There was, of course, a lot about doors. And I think in this case, what was trying to be conveyed by the use of so many doors, because it's not just, oh, hey, there's a locked door or hey, whatever. There's a lot of doors in general. A lot of the shots as they're set up are looking through doorways. I mean, it's done in a very subtle way. And I think that sort of is indicative of, you know, we are opening the doors of, you know, to whatever that in people's minds. Well, you know, the band The Doors is about the doors of perception, right? So, and this movie does talk a lot about perception, both in the fact that she's supposed to be an unreliable narrator, we think, right, Barrett? And also in the fact that, you know, right, true fiction, the whole thing. So that connects to it. There's also a lot of lamps, specifically. Yeah. Not light.
I love lamps.
But the interesting thing was, it's not just, oh, here's a lamp in a room. When you look at the shots, it's like the lamps are being featured almost in most of them. So those were two things I noticed. Again, that could mean shedding light on things or what's in the dark. I'm not really too sure. But those were only the two motif things I noticed that were kind of interesting. I'm sure there were more. I just, you know, you can't catch them all. Everybody's going to catch something different. But anyway, that was really, that was the only other thing I really wanted to mention. I think I'm pretty much crapped out. I've talked enough.
Sure. I love your point though, Chrissy, about the doors and perception. That's mm-hmm. a really good point, because with all the doors in this film and how a lot of them were locked and what's behind them and all that, and her being gaslight, or is she going crazy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's no doubt that that was specifically referenced. Absolutely.
And I forget what that actual quote is.
Yeah, it comes from.
I forget, and I don't even remember where it's from or who the hell said it. I don't remember, but it's.
I think it was Aldous Huxley, maybe?
Yes, it was Aldous Huxley.
Oh, awesome. Okay, I'm glad somebody remembers, because, you know, I was just too baked.
Yeah. Well, I know, because my favorite band, The Doors, are new.
Oh, I love The Doors. Yeah, really into The Doors. Yeah, so anyway.
Yeah, so that's where they got the title. It's The Doors of Perception is a book by Aldous Huxley, published in 1954. All right, so before we get into our final thoughts and all that wonderful stuff, I guess we can get into some news or what we've been watching or things of that nature. Eric, I know you usually have a good many things that you like to let listeners know about.
Well, hang on, I'm pulling on my letterbox here. Let's see. Since last time, what is 11 minus 7? That's 4. Okay. since the last time, actually, you know what? I haven't watched anything other than what we covered on Cinema a la Carte and what we're going to cover next week. So I got nothing to talk about right now.
Yeah, all right. Very well. Very well. Not a problem. For me, I'm reading Swan Song by, what's the author's name?
Robert McCammon. Good book.
Thank you. Yeah. So I'm reading that. I'm on page 660 or so. So not too
also
much
a big
more.
Book.
Yes. So close to 1,000 pages. So going through a pretty good, the book is pretty solid. I like it a lot. It's another good apocalypse story with some supernatural elements added. The characters are really well done. Folks who like that type of fiction should definitely pick it up.
check it out. But I did almost throw the book across the as Chrissy, you said, or no, it was Amy Rain said that something about you can't throw it hard enough, but they killed the dog. It pissed me off. So that really upset me. Yeah. It was terrible. So I'm reading that. So that's going good. Probably going to have that finished within the next time we do a podcast. And then that's pretty much it. Oh, I watched 4 episodes of The Office last night, so that was good. And that's it. Yeah, nothing else related to genre. What about you, Abe? Anything?
Nothing really new on my end. I've just been trying to get to the films that we've been cut during these last few weeks. But that's really it.
All right. What about you, Chrissy? Got anything?
Yeah, I have a couple of things. I am reading Providence Noir, which is part of the Akashic Noir book series. So they are short, crime stories set in various different cities. And I picked up the Providence one. And I'm very, very happy with it. It is edited by Ann Hood. The stories are excellent. I have read a few in this series. This series is huge now. Back when I started it, there was maybe only 6 different books. Now there's I don't know. There's at least 100 titles in the series, probably more. But I can tell you, I will highly recommend it. The big thing with Akashic Books and this series is what they do is they get an editor, and the editor goes out and gets crime stories by writers either from that city or from that state, usually. And these stories are very clearly set in those specific settings. So Providence Noir is literally set all over Providence. And so you can, take the book and drive around and go, oh, here's Angel Street and here's this and here's that. And you can actually see it. Baltimore Noir in that series is excellent. Bronx Noir is excellent. If anybody out there is looking for good noir, I definitely recommend those 3. What's the one that's terrible? Cape Cod Noir was awful. Stay away from it. Lone Star Noir was absolutely sucked. I couldn't even get past the first
Lone Star.
Oh, and I was so excited. It was Texas, and I was like, yay. No, it was so boring. I don't even know. I don't know if the editor was on crack or what. No, the stories were awful. And then there was one called Indian Country Noir, which was also really crappy. And New Haven Noir was not good either. But Baltimore, Bronx, Miami. Miami Noir was awesome, too. That one was a good one. And Providence. So if anybody's looking for some noir, or if you didn't write those titles down, you want to know what's what, just drop me a note. But I'm telling you, there's so many titles. So you can just go and choose what you want. That's Akashic Books. The other thing I did was I watched this movie called Population 4436, which is on Amazon Prime this month for free. So if you're a Prime member, you can watch it. It's kind of a little like Shirley Jackson's The Lottery. It's a typical, there's this town and something creepy is going on in it. But it wasn't bad. It was just kind of fun. I would say light horror watching, entertaining little folk horror piece. If somebody's looking for something for free and you don't have Netflix and you just want to watch something that's entertaining. The other thing is, my short story Threading the Needle has been released in Ghastly Gastronomy, which is a cookbook from Madness Heart Press. And that was just released. And you can pick it up on Kindle and in paperback on Amazon, or you can go to Madness Heart Press. And if you like, for example, PDFs, you can just get a downloadable PDF for $3. Or you can order the book from them or the Mobi or whatever other format you want. So that's it. That's all I got this time around.
You got my brain stuck in Spaceballs mode, Christy, when you said Lone Star.
Only one man would dare give me the raspberry.
Lone Star.
That was a great film.
Dude, I just watched that recently, too. You know, it's been kind of fun. Oh, and we did revisit this week all of the Christopher Guest films. So Spinal Tap, which is originally Rob Reiner, of course, but Spinal Tap, Waiting for Guffman, For Your Consideration, Best in Show, Mascots, all of those.
Mighty Wind.
Yeah, we own them all in this. We own the whole series, except for Mascots, because Mascots is a Netflix original, and that is the only place you can see it. So if you like Christopher Guest movies, you know, Waiting for Guffman, A Mighty Wind, Spinal Tap, it's called Mascots, and it is on Netflix. And if you have Netflix, it's only available there. So,
I haven't seen that one.
I
did see Best in Show, and I recommended it to somebody who actually shows dogs. And
they didn't think it was funny.
They didn't think it was funny because it's real shit. Yeah,
exactly. They came back and they were like, "That's not funny." I was like, "Ooh, they nailed it."
Mascots is awesome. Just to give you a quick synopsis without spoilers. Mascots focuses on a competition of sporting mascots. So, like, they go and they do these routines. Now, I don't think it's an actual real thing.
Like, guys that dance on the sidelines?
Yes. Yes. It's hilarious, Eric. If you have Netflix, you owe it to yourself to go see this. It's just called Mascots. And it's Christopher Guest. It's fantastic.
Anything else, Chris?
No. That's it.
All right. What about you, Barrett? What do you got?
I'm not sure it's genre-related, but it is creepy. I watched Kemper on Kemper on Oxygen On Demand documentary, and which caused me to go out and read The Coed Killer by Margaret Cheney, which is quite an interesting book. It's written in 76, and the first three quarters details Kemper and serial killer Edmund Kemper. And then the last quarter is about justice and talking about insanity, and, you know, the legal definition, the medical definition, and what's going on in the 70s, closing down mental clinics and all that. So it's quite an interesting true crime
book about wackadoodles.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Well, Eric,
behavioral health individuals. We are PC on this show. Oh my God.
No, he was just wackadoodle.
There is two definitions too. Yeah, because the law doesn't recognize sociopaths and narcissists and all them as mental health disorders, because they say as long as you know that you're doing wrong, you are guilty, while the medical community recognizes those as mental health issues. So yeah, you're absolutely right. So that book sounds interesting.
Yeah, the last quarter of it is very interesting because it's taking place in the 70s, but not much has changed.
Yeah,
that's the funnier part.
And Cold Blood does the same thing. They talk about the definition of that too, and how sociopaths and where they're defined in the law versus medical, even though it is a mental disorder. I know you've been watching Ozark.
You keep pushing me on that one. I'm trying to watch Ozark. I'm not done with season one yet, so I will let you know when I am done with season one and moving on to season two.
And how's it going, though? How's the show going?
I like it a lot. It's pretty good.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to talking about it. Season three.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Good stuff. And what else you been watching? Anything else?
I watched a movie that I did not know existed. I watched Vacancy 2, which turns out to be a prequel to Vacancy.
What?
I had seen Vacancy in the theater, and I didn't even realize there was a Vacancy 2. Vacancy was, yes.
Wow, okay.
Well, Vacancy 2 was not. It was direct-to-video.
It had one of the Wilson brothers, so I could see Vacancy making theaters.
Yeah, and Kate Beckinsale was in it. So, yeah, it made theaters, but the second one did not, and it shows why. If you watch it, it's not the greatest film, but it's a prequel, and I hate prequels to movies where you know that pretty much everyone has to die. You know, it's like a Texas Chainsaw Massacre prequel.
Is there any major stars in the sequel or the prequel?
No major stars. No.
Okay.
There's one guy that played the kid in Big that, you know, turns into Tom Hanks. That's about all I can say about it.
Okay. And but you said it was by the same people, right? It was actually made by the same people?
I'm not sure if it was made by the same people, but it's, you know, it's a prequel, so it's the same storyline.
Gotcha.
It tries to set up the first movie.
Gotcha. Anything else?
Nothing else.
All right. Sounds good. All right. So before we give our final thoughts, Eric, you actually do another podcast with your buddy Dan?
I do. It's a general interest podcast called the Askansity Podcast. That's spelled Askancity. You can find it wherever you got this one.
Excellent. And Chrissy, besides that new story in the gastro anthology.
Gastronomy, yes.
Yes, you actually have a book that, a magazine that you publish online that people can download?
I do. I have the magazine is called 34 Orchard. We specialize in very dark fiction. Our first we publish 2 issues a year. They are available for free at 34 Orchard, written like an address, except no street after it, .com. And you can go there and get the PDF for free. There is a place to donate $1.99, or if you do feel called to donate and you'd like to donate more, I do pay $50 per poem or story that does come completely out of my pocket, except for donations. So if you feel called to, my PayPal address is on there. You can just PayPal me more, or you can donate $1.99, or you can just go and read it for free. It's nobody has to donate to get this. You can just go get it. That's the whole point of it. We want everybody to be able to access this really fantastic short fiction, and a lot of it is dark, and it's dark in an emotionally intense way that, in all honesty, a lot of magazines are not touching right now. So if you like that sort of stuff, 34 Orchard is where you need to stop over and bring a cheap platter.
There you go. And Abe, me, you, Barrett, and Kevin Letts just recorded an episode that's coming out.
Yes, we recorded Whisperer in the Dark, a Lovecraftian story. We've been covering some of his work as well as Stephen King's in the past. We have another one set to be recorded probably by the end of this month, as long as everything goes as planned. I won't ask what it is, but just look forward to it.
All right, very good. And Barrett, me and you did a Halloween Boutique Psychotronic Review episode that's coming out later this month on what book?
The Stand, and it is the first of 2 parts, because the book is so long, we needed 2 parts.
That's right. So look out for all that stuff, too. And definitely check out Chrissy's online book and download it. It's got some good stories there. And she'd be, as you said, Chrissy, you'd appreciate anybody who donates, because it was hard work and it came out of your own money. And then definitely check out Eric's podcast, Askansity, which has been running as long as Dark Discussions, and has some good stuff over there. And unfortunately, Eric has to be held up by his buddy Dan, because Dan is the star of that show.
I'm not even going to argue with you on that.
I was waiting for you to laugh or something, but I was trying to be funny, but yeah, I guess it
wasn't.
No, because
no,
it's true.
No, people, Dan's the entertainment value for sure. I do get the occasional compliment from somebody about what a good job I do of keeping the show moving forward while he's trying to take it off the rails.
Indeed. All right, so very good. So I guess we can get into our final thoughts on this film tonight. So let's start with you, Abe.
I did like this film. I thought the performances of the cast were really strong, especially namely our two leads. There were some really cool twists, but there were some that felt really forced or unnecessary, or there was just not enough build-up to make them feel like complete payoffs. There were some really cool scenes of my that kind of left you questioning how reliable was the things you're seeing or what was being said. And it was an enjoyable watch. I think if they had given the character a little more of a defined background and scars, the descent into what unfolds would have felt a little more satisfying. That being said, it's still worth a watch. It's on Amazon rental if you want to check it out. And yeah, it was a good watch. Not flawed, but still enjoyable.
All right, very good. And let's go with you, Eric.
I enjoyed this movie. I didn't really stop and think about many of the flaws we discussed tonight until this discussion tonight. It did not detract from my enjoyment of the film, so I still thought it was really well acted. And even though it has a little some problems, mostly towards the end, I would still recommend it.
Excellent. And Chrissy.
Sorry, I got my mute thing backwards. Yeah, I would, you know, listen, it's a fun little hour and a half. If you like that kind of a thing, that sort of movie, that sort of, you know, I don't know what to call it, but like, you know, girl in distress and, you know, hacks people up to escape, then this is your bag. We did have a very interesting discussion tonight. We definitely think there are some problems with this movie. I think most of us do. But, I mean, you know, it's not a train wreck. I mean, geez, there's worse. So if you're interested in it, I would say it probably is worth the $4 rental if you like what you've heard tonight. So, but that's it. I really don't have too much to say about it other than that.
All right. Very well. Barrett.
I really enjoyed this film. I thought the acting was great. I actually put this as number 2 on my list for this year. After The Invisible Man, I really, really enjoyed it. There are flaws. It's easy to criticize any movie, but I don't think that in general they totally distract from the movie, and the movie is really well done, well paced, and again, the acting is phenomenal. It's really well done.
All right. Well, yeah, for me, it was a pretty solid film. I had some issues with it, and kind of was disappointed with the last half hour of the film, so it definitely won't be one of my top films of the year, but the acting, as everybody's mentioned, is really top notch for two kind of unknown actors. They did really good, especially the guy that played Caleb. He really, really played his role of whether or not he was gaslighting. It was just good. The acting was just good. It definitely has some flaws, as Eric said. But it's a quick hour and 30-minute film, and I think most horror fans would generally like it because it does have enough gore and crazy visuals and things of that nature that it holds up for the nominal horror fan. All right. So once again, that was 2020 True Fiction, it's called. It's a film directed by a man, and well, he actually wrote it too, Braden Croft, and it stars John Cassini and Sarah Garcia, and it's available anywhere you can rent films. So with all that stated, Eric, why don't you let us out?
Alrighty, thanks for tuning in. Let's talk about True Fiction. Come back next week. We'll have another topic.